Welcome to Irregular Climate, where we take a look at the irregular climate in our atmosphere and the irrational climate of global warming denialism.
This week, the EPA says CO2 reduction is cheap.
The idiot politician of the week.
Expert credibility on climate change.
Lying deniers.
A 5-month-old apology from the Sunday Times.
Lies, polls, and damned lying polls.
The skeptic debunk of the week.
And whale poop and carbon dioxide. I am Dan Mutall.
And I'm Graham Wayne. First up in our news round, the EPA have released an analysis of the Kerry-Lieberman climate bill and what it would cost. According to this analysis, the bill would cost the average American household about $79 to $146 a year. That's over the next 40 years. Now, this is not the economy-destroying cost many have made it out to be, despite the fact that the costs are often exaggerated and made to sound like it's going to completely wreck the American economy. I wonder, though, Dan, do you think this is really going to make any difference in the overall scope of America's position relative to the rest of the world?
Well, that's something that's very difficult to say, but what the EPA did say is they said that if the U.S. passes something like the Kerry-Lieberman climate bill, and if it helps, if that bill helps negotiate an international agreement on carbon emissions, we'll have about a 75% chance of keeping temperature rises below 2 degrees Celsius, which is sometimes seen as kind of the danger, anything above that being the danger zone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those are some very big ifs, and there's a lot of uncertainty there, mainly because we haven't seen what an international agreement would look like. But the EPA says if we do nothing, our chances of meeting that goal are roughly 1%. So it's a substantial increase in our ability to successfully tackle this problem, even though significant uncertainties remain. This week, the idiot politician of the week is Joe Barton for apologizing to BP because the White House is working to ensure that BP pays for the damage it has caused. This is what he said. I apologize. I do not want to live in a country where any time a citizen or a corporation does something that is legitimately wrong is subject to some sort of political pressure that, again, in my words, amounts to some sort of shakedown. This political pressure is just the White House ensuring that BP pays for the damage it has done. This is the personal responsibility that Republicans claim to support. Now, Barton did sort of apologize, but not really, apologizing for people misconstruing what he said. Well, what he said was pretty clear, and apologizing for someone misunderstanding what you said is not really apologizing. It's the opposite of an apology. Now, as expected, Barton has been defended by people on plenty of people on Fox News and other right-wing luminaries like Bill Kristol and Rush Limbaugh. I don't really know what to say about this. This is absurd. It really is beyond belief. But Barton is no stranger to this kind of idiocy. Having previously stated that CO2 cannot be harmful because it exists in a can of Coke, and that it isn't a carcinogen. Well, great. But that doesn't mean it can't be harmful. And that we can adapt to global warming because we can adapt to higher temperatures by finding some shade. That's the type of intellect we're dealing with here. Which begs the question, how does someone like that get elected? The answer is pretty simple. With more oil and gas money than any other U.S. politician, that's how he gets elected. And it's a disgrace.
Another news story this week, which deserves some attention, is a recent study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which takes a look at the much-disputed consensus in the scientific community about the origins of climate change. This is an argument that rages very intensely because although there have been a couple of studies, first of all the Oreskes study and then later on Doran in 2009, The studies have been disputed as to exactly how many scientists support the general consensus of the IPCC. Now, both of these previous studies found that there was a great consensus behind the principles that the IPCC laid out. This new study, using different methodology, has found 97% of those who they thought were qualified supported the IPCC's position. So who are these experts, and how do we determine what their credibility is?
Well, the way this study looked at it is by looking at expertise and prominence. Expertise is the number of papers published on climate science in for a particular author, and prominence is how often those papers were cited. And they used Google Scholar, which is an open tool that anyone can use, to determine and rank climate scientists according to these metrics.
What we're talking about here, in terms of papers published, you're talking about peer-reviewed papers, yeah?
Yes. Google Scholar does actually include non-peer-reviewed sources, but it actually went to great lengths to verify each of these each of the sources in that were cited by Google Scholar to determine that they were, you know, were up to snuff, that they weren't some, you know, an industry journal or whatever that isn't peer reviewed.
Sure. And in respect of prominence measured by citations, the number of citations is a very good indication of how important a particular piece of work is.
Right. Generally, the way it works is good scientific studies get cited a lot. Scientific studies that are wrong or not very relevant either get refuted occasionally, but more often than not, they're just ignored. No one cites them. They're just, you know, they're just ignored.
Sure.
And then the authors of this study actually went one step further, and they divided these group of climate scientists that they looked at into two camps: those that accept the basic conclusions of the IPCC, and those that don't. And they did that by looking at kind of open letters and statements that they have signed. So there's been a bunch of petitions and statements that have been signed, both for the IPCC, supporting it, and both against it. And so that's kind of how they divvied up the people they looked at into pro or accepting the IPCC and rejecting the IPCC conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found was that 97 to 98% of climate researchers most actively publishing in the field support the basic tenets of global warming outlined by the IPCC, and that the relative climate expertise and scientific prominence of these researchers outweighs the climate expertise and scientific prominence of the researchers that do not accept the IPCC.
Less qualified in some respects.
Exactly. They actually, the paper goes a bit further and looked at researchers with fewer than 20 climate publications comprise roughly 80% of the group of researchers who are unconvinced by the evidence for global warming, as opposed to less than 10% for the group of researchers that are convinced, which indicates that the bulk of the unconvinced researchers on the most prominent signatory statements and such have not really published extensively in the peer-reviewed literature, which is something that is not really surprising to people who have looked at this. It's nice to have a more rigorous methodology that confirms what a lot of people have already kind of known kind of instinctively just by looking at it and kind of looking at the list of names on both camps.
Yeah, you're talking about a hunch, really, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, more than a hunch, but it wasn't, I would say, anecdotal evidence, and now
yeah,
it's
sure.
It's more quantitative. One of the main criticisms of this paper is that it's an appeal to authority. But that's really not what it is. It's an attempt to determine what the authoritative opinion on the matter says.
Sure, they're not saying whether or not the scientist is right or wrong. What they're saying is this is what the scientist's position actually is.
Right. And, you know, it indicates that the more expertise and prominence one has in this field, the more likely you are to agree that or to accept that climate change is a significant issue. Mm-hmm. And what this study really does is it really demolishes the notion that has been promoted in the media that there are two viable camps within the scientific establishment. There's a camp that says global warming is real and that it's a problem, and that there's a camp that says global warming is either not real or not a problem or good for us or caused by the sun or a bunch of mutually exclusive reasons. But what this shows really is that there aren't two camps. There is mainstream climate science, which encompasses 97 to 98% of climatologists. And then there's a very small group that has less scientific prominence and expertise, as defined by the study, that that says that is separate from the mainstream that says it's not an issue. Really, we have to the media now has been shown very clearly that there aren't two camps, and the media should stop treating these two camps as equal. Because they're not.
Good. How do you feel about the methodology that was used?
Well, as with most methodologies, it's not perfect, and there are some criticisms that can be labeled. I mean, first of all, this doesn't measure credibility so much, and of course, if they did that, that would be a huge accomplishment. Credibility is one of those things that's notoriously hard to measure.
Mm-hmm.
So it measures kind of expertise and prominence as kind of narrowly defined by this paper, as you know, number of studies and number of citations. But the sort of one of the main criticisms is that by splitting these climate scientists into two groups, those that accept the IPCC, those that don't, it really removes a lot of nuance that exists there. And of course, reality is not kind of two. Camps, but more of a continuum, although because there's such an overwhelming number that agree with the IPCC camp, a more nuanced approach isn't likely to show much more support for the disagree with the IPCC camp. I mean, there is a continuum, but the bulk of the people on that continuum are heavily weighted towards the agree with the IPCC side. It's not evenly distributed. There's a great graph that's created by Michael Tobis that we'll link to in the show notes. It kind of shows this quite clearly. It's kind of a two bell curves. One is the main mainstream climatologists, I guess what we would call accept the IPCC bit. And the other, much smaller hump, is those that disagree with the IPCC, and it really visually kind of separates the two out and shows how where the expert opinion lies, and it really does fall in line with what this study shows, and this study also falls in line with previous studies that have looked at this question using various methodologies. So it's nice to see kind of confirmation from or replication and confirmation of conclusions with different methodologies, because that really increases the confidence we have in this basic conclusion.
And no sooner had we finished that piece than the usual suspects started coming out of the woodwork to criticize it. Here's Dan now with the roundup.
The criticism to this study is really starting to heat up. Up first, we have Roger Pilkey Jr., who is claiming that this study is some sort of blacklist. Which is odd, because if you take a look at the study, there is no list. Don't you need a list in order to make a blacklist? And then things take a turn for the worse. This got picked up by Anthony Watts, who says it doesn't get any uglier than this. Excuse me? How is this ugly? I really don't see it. The scientists who were classified as unconvinced by the evidence all signed public statements to that effect. Public statements. Are they now embarrassed by those statements? Do they not stand by what they signed? All this study did was analyze in aggregate how their expertise and prominence compares with those scientists who signed public statements supportive of the IPCC, scientists who have been convinced by the evidence. How is that ugly? And if that's as ugly as it gets, then when we really are doing quite well, because compared with deniers like James Dinglepole, who writes for the UK Telegraph, there is simply no comparison. This is a headline from his blog post. Climate change skeptics have smaller members, uglier wives, dumber kids, says new study made up by warmists. Notice how even his headline is a lie? There's nothing true in that statement at all. But let's get on with his actual article. He says, are there no depths to which man bear pig worshippers will not stoop in order to shore up their intellectually, morally, and scientifically bankrupt cause? Apparently not, as we see from this latest study based on petty, spiteful, Stasi-like blacklist produced by an obscure Canadian warmist, outraged, outrageously aggrandized, and by being published by the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Wow. Who knew collating the names on public, and I cannot stress this enough, public statements and doing some basic aggregated analysis and then not publishing those names was equivalent to a Stasi-like blacklist? And yet Dinglepole claims that it is we that are the ones sinking to untold depths? Again, just so everyone is abundantly clear on this, the names used in the study were public and not published in the study. To find out who was counted amongst the unconvinced group, one needs to go back to the original public statements. Statements that are typically published and promoted on denier sites like Dinglepole's blog. The rest of his article is no better. It isn't the authors of the study who are stooping to untold depths, but the deniers who are unwilling or unable to accept that maybe, just maybe, they are wrong and those with the most expertise and prominence are right. And finally, Jim Prawl, one of the authors of the study, clearly demonstrates why the deniers' response has been completely hypocritical, stating, for Mark Morano, who's played a key role in spreading the disinformation, for Mark Morano's attempt to swiftboat this Stasi-esque, what amazing gall. He's famous for having built a long list of climate skeptics during his term with Senator Inhofe. Hypocrite. Why wasn't that list Stasi-esque? Just because he agreed with their side? Morano publicized his list relentlessly and listed many more names as skeptics than I have. Morano also tended to quote mine, leading to false positives, where the person in question would protest their inclusion as unrepresentative of their actual views. Yet Morano would refuse to take them off. He'd just point to the mined quote he had, ignoring anything the source might say about being taken out of context or trying to tell him what their actual views are. If the fear that someone biased against supporters of one side could focus their bias on people on a list, why was it okay for Morano to subject people to that risk with his list? Was Morano's list Stasi-esque as well? If not, why not? Jim Prawl really does get to the hypocrisy of the matter. Perhaps the most useful aspect of this study is not the study itself, but the hypocrisy that it exposed in deniers. This hypocrisy is nothing new, but it is always illuminating to see it highlighted so clearly.
It seems like deception is the theme of this week's show. Not that we intended it to be. But now we've got a story about Mike Holm from the University of East Anglia, who has been having similar problems with misrepresentation.
Yeah, well, it happened by one of our perhaps more prominent deniers writing in the National Post, Lawrence Solomon, who pretty much wrote in his usual fact-free style that the IPCC consensus was a fraud, and he attributed this claim to Mike Holm, completely twisting his words around. But then this, of course, was picked up by Mark Morano, who asked the question if the media will now apologize for being complicit in the consensus con.
Right, and just remind us who Mark Morano is.
Mark Morano is, he runs the site Climate Depot. He worked for a long time as Senator Inhofe's main spin doctor, and Senator Inhofe is the senator who said, the U.S. senator who said that climate change is the greatest hoax perpetrated on the American public. And he's basically, Mark Moran is a guy who's a very effective communicator who is completely unbound by the truth. I do get his emails in my inbox, and every single, I don't take anything he says without a huge grain of salt. If I'm going to accept something that he says is true, I'm going to double check it myself. I'm going to go back to the original source, because more often than not, he is he's lying, plain and simple. So before we get too far into this, let's clarify what Lawrence Solomon claimed that that Hume said. He said Lawrence Solomon claimed that that Hume claimed that the IPCC consensus was a fraud, that there wasn't that this consensus just doesn't exist.
Okay, this is the consensus that we've just been talking about, that these three studies have now confirmed.
Yeah, basically, that's the consensus that that apparently, according to Lawrence Solomon, doesn't exist. The IPCC is a fraud, or sorry, the IPCC consensus is a fraud, even though, as we talked about just prior to this.
But he also claims that Mike Hume has this same opinion. Is that correct?
He does. Yes. So he says he pretty much claims that this claim that Solomon makes comes from Hume, and. So I think it's, now that we've kind of established what he says, it's worth it to look at Hume's response, because he Hume is not someone who likes to be misrepresented, especially having his claims twisted completely around. So this is what he said. He says, first, I did not say the IPCC misleads anyone. It is claims that are made by other commentators, such as a caricatured claim I offer in the paper, that have the potential to mislead. Second, they have a potential to mislead if they give the impression that every statement in IPCC reports is signed off by every IPCC author and reviewer. Patently, they are not and cannot. Third, it is that chapter lead authors, say 10 to 20 experts, on detection and attribution, who craft the sentence about detection and attribution, which is then scrutinized and vetted by reviewers and government officials. Similarly, statements about what may happen to the meridional overturning circulation of the ocean are crafted by those experts in ocean science, and statements about future sea level rise by sea level experts, and so on.
Okay, which sounds like a long-winded way of saying, basically, certain experts are going to review and sign off on those areas of science that they understand.
Right, which, of course, is what you want. I mean, this is the whole thing about expertise. You go to the experts. If a scientist studies climate modeling and another scientist studies ocean currents, well, if you're going to get... write a chapter of the IPCC on ocean currents, you want to go to the ocean currents guy, not the climate modeler.
Sure.
Even though, I mean, the climate modeler probably knows more about ocean currents than I do, and that most people, the ocean currents guy knows more than the climate modeler. I mean, he is, and people who study ocean currents and that group of people are the experts, and that's who you go to.
Yeah. Hume also says in this statement, he says, giving the impression that the IPCC consensus means everyone agrees with everyone else, as I think some well-meaning but uninformed commentaries do, or have a tendency to do, is unhelpful. It doesn't reflect the uncertain, exploratory, and sometimes contested nature of scientific knowledge. So, you know, I mean, what he's saying here is, if you understand how science works, you know that there is equivocation, you know, that there's a great deal of debate. I mean, scientists are pretty competitive, actually. But a consensus is the general view of it. It's as you described it earlier, it's this current of opinion that's moving in a very similar direction, but it's comprised of a lot of separate parts.
Right. And, I mean, this kind of goes back to the one of the criticisms of the study we were discussing earlier about kind of creating this dichotomy of those scientists who accept the IPCC and those who don't, when reality is more nuanced than that. But which is what Hume was referring to. And really, his statements are not at all what Solomon and Morano claimed. Even more importantly, they both willfully ignored the fact that Hume stated that the IPCC process has been criticized as being too conservative, something which we have said in the past as well. He's got a quick statement here that says, "But consensus making can also lead to criticism for being too conservative, as Hansen has most visibly argued." And that's James Hansen of NASA Goddard Institute of Space Studies.
Sure.
Who's one of the top climatologists in the United States. "Was the IPCC assessment report 4 too conservative in reaching its consensus about future sea level rise? Many glaciologists and oceanographers think they were, leading to what Hansen attacks as scientific reticence."
Yeah, the IPCC, I mean, it's pretty well known amongst the scientific community that they tried not to inflame the situation with exaggerated predictions. It was really the media jumping on the back of it when things started getting out of hand. But then that's what the media do, isn't it? That's how they sell papers.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, the media, a lot of nuance is lost in the media. That's to be expected. It's a complex issue. And the nuance will be lost. That's to be expected. Most reporters have very little knowledge of the actual science. Science reporters themselves are becoming a rare breed. So really, nuance is being lost. Nuance is lost in the media. I mean, that's, take a 3,000-page report and summarize it in a 500-word article. You're gonna have to cut some stuff out, and nuance is gonna have to go.
The trouble is, of course, that you're also relying on the quality of the reporters' scientific education in order to know which bits to emphasize and which bits to cut out.
Yeah, and that's something that's been declining recently, quite dramatically, as newspapers suffer. Quite desperate financial situations.
Yeah.
To me, the bottom line here is that, you know, the only real con is the one being pushed by Solomon and Morano, which leads to the question, will they now apologize for being complicit in the consensus con that they themselves invented? I wouldn't hold my breath. Inventing quotes is nothing new. Sir John Hooton, who played a critical role in establishing the IPCC, has a quote attributed to him that says, "Unless we announce disasters, no one will listen." Only problem with this is it was completely made up, completely fabricated, and it is in fact the opposite of what Hooton thinks, and as we've discussed, of what the IPCC actually is like.
Yeah, and Hooton, if listeners are not familiar with him, you know, I mean, this is a very, very distinguished climate scientist. He was professor of atmospheric physics at Oxford University. He was director general of the Met Office here in the UK. He established the Hadley Centre for Margaret Thatcher. And, of course, he was the first head of the scientific working group of the IPCC. He was the lead editor of the panel's first three reports. So this is a man that, you know, the idea that he would say something so manipulative, "unless we announce disasters, no one will listen." It's a statement. It's remarkably crass for a man who would be dealing, who would be so aware of the political implications of a statement like that, and how it would be used. And the fact is that no one has ever been able to figure out where this first came from. And certainly he has routinely denied it. I think it first appeared about 3 years ago, didn't it?
Yeah.
It's the first time it seemed to have appeared in print.
It appeared in, I think it was 2006. I'm just pulling
up
November,
the... Yeah, November 2006. I've got it here. It appeared in the Sunday Telegraph in Australia was the first time it came out.
Yeah, and... definitely not attribute. That's the furthest back anyone's been able to attribute that quote, and it was attributed to a right wing columnist, Piers Ackerman, who in the Sunday Telegraph.
Yeah,
he's actually the guy who said the quote. He attributed it to someone else, but he made it up.
But what he claimed was in that piece was that it appeared in Houghton's book, Global Warming, The Complete Briefing. That was a book that he wrote in 1994.
Right, but it doesn't actually appear in that book.
It doesn't actually appear there at all.
I mean, that's an easily verifiable fact. Now, the fact that this has been, that was completely made up, completely fabricated, hasn't stopped it from, this quote, from being widely circulated. It is, it appears in over 100,000 pages on the internet. So that's why these lies exist, because the famous quote says, a lie can make it around the world while the truth is still putting on its boots. So it's, unfortunately, it's the norm, and kind of brings us to our next story, which is that the Sunday Times in the UK finally apologizes for inventing Amazon Gate.
Yeah. Now, Amazon Gate is just one of these crazy things that you just, you look back at it and you think, how on earth did this ever get going? Because it revolved around the misrepresentation of a piece of the IPCC report where, regrettably, but it's not really a big deal, they misattributed some information. And that's how it kicked off, isn't it?
Right. Well, it wasn't even that they misattributed it so much as that they cited what's called the gray literature, which was, in this case, a WWF report, World Wildlife Fund report, that actually forgot to cite this figure. But this figure was in the peer-reviewed literature and was well-supported by the peer-reviewed literature. It's just the IPCC, instead of citing that literature, cited the gray literature, which didn't properly cite this figure. So the IPCC made an error in not citing the best source, which it should be criticized for. I mean, it should always cite the best sources that's available.
But it, I mean, that's the procedure.
But it's not a big deal. Yeah, it's not a big deal. Sure. But this was blown out of proportion by a reporter, Jonathan Leake, writing in the Sunday Times in the UK. And he essentially made up this whole story that this claim was completely false. It was not supported. It's an embarrassment to the IPCC. This error in quotation mark that Leake invented was published shortly after the legitimate error that was found in the IPCC estimation of Himalayan glaciers melting.
Oh, so he was jumping on that. He was jumping on that bandwagon, basically.
He was jumping on a narrative, again, which was something that was a relatively minor error that didn't even make it to the summary report. So, you know, politicians never really even looked at it. It wasn't widely reported, but it was a legitimate error. And then this, you know, Jonathan Leake jumped on this bandwagon.
But curiously, there's a sort of the first of several twists in this story is that he didn't just sit there kind of making this up on his own. He actually enlisted the help of an expert.
He actually talked to several experts who all told him that people like Simon Lewis, who is an expert on rainforests at the University of Leeds in the UK, mm-hmm. And they told him that, you know, the IPCC was correct, but that it should have cited the relevant studies rather than a report by the World Wildlife Fund. So the claims were correct. They were accurate, but that's not what was reported. In fact, Leake went so far as to clear the story with Simon Lewis. And it's worth noting that Leake talked to several other experts, not just Simon Lewis, who all told them basically the same thing.
Right.
And so he actually reviewed the article with Simon Lewis, and Simon Lewis said, yes, that's good. And then, kind of at the last minute, the article went significant revisions, twisted what Simon Lewis said 180 degrees, twisted the whole tone of the article, claiming that the IPCC was wrong about the Amazon. So from being a broadly accurate article, it was turned by an editor or by Leake or by someone at the Sunday Times, we don't know who, to something that was no longer broadly accurate, was completely wrong.
Right. But of course, the other thing is that Simon Lewis, who had contributed his expertise to this story, now felt that he'd been completely misrepresented because his name was used in the original story. But he hadn't actually said or endorsed the view that the article put across at all.
Right. I mean, yeah, Simon Lewis's point was, you know, what he said. His quotes were completely taken out of context and completely twisted around. And, I mean, the story actually spread around the media and the denialosphere quite substantially. I actually wrote a quick article on it, and it got a lot of hits at the time. A lot of people were looking for it. So much so that a bunch of experts on the tropical rainforest signed an open letter stating that the point is, however, that the statement made in the IPCC about the sensitivity of Amazon forest drought was consistent with our knowledge at the time and has been reinforced by new studies. But even an open letter by a bunch of experts on the subject was not enough for the Sunday Times to print a correction.
Mm. Lewis couldn't get any kind of result from the Sunday Times. He had contacted them frequently and expressed his concerns about the way he'd been misrepresented, but they wouldn't print a correction, which then forced him to file a complaint, a 30-page complaint with the Press Complaints Commission here in the UK, accusing the Sunday Times of publishing inaccurate, misleading or distorted information about climate change and about remarks he'd made to a reporter for the article. And it was that complaint to the PCC that seems now to have sparked some action.
Right. So finally, almost 5 months after the original article was published, the Sunday Times published this correction. The IPCC's Amazon statement is supported by the peer-reviewed scientific evidence. In the case of the WWF report, the figure had, in error, not been referenced, but was based on research by the respected Amazon Environmental Research Institute, which did relate to the impact of climate change. The article also quoted criticism of the IPCC's use of the WWF report by Dr. Simon Lewis, a Royal Society Research Fellow at the University of Leeds and leading specialist in tropical forest ecology. We accept that in his quoted remarks, Dr. Lewis was making the general point that both the IPCC and WWF should have cited the appropriate peer-reviewed scientific literature, as he made clear to us at the time, including by sending us some of the peer-reviewed literature. Dr. Lewis does not dispute the scientific basis for both the IPCC and the WWF report statements on the potential vulnerability of the Amazon rainforest to drought caused by climate change.
That's exactly the opposite of what they said. They said it disputed that he said both the IPCC and the WWF reports had no scientific basis and were not legitimate.
Right.
That's the words they put in his mouth.
Yeah, they completely twisted his views around, which led to, and I forget where I first heard this, some very good advice for any scientists who are giving interviews to the press, that they should record the interviews they give. So that way, if they are misrepresented, they can release those recordings, and they should probably make it clear to the reporters beforehand that they're going to do this, but they can release those recordings to the public to make it abundantly clear that they are being misrepresented.
Sure.
And anyway, so that's probably the best piece of advice. Really, it is great to see that the Sunday Times is finally correcting the original stories. A lot of newspapers these days never seem to correct mistakes. Washington Post is a prime example with its various columns by George Will, which have been debunked by other columns and other news articles and even a political comic in the Washington Post,
right?
But the original articles were never corrected. But it really is unforgivable that it took almost 5 months and a complaint to the Press Complaints Commission to get this correction done. There's just no excuse for that.
No, but the significance of it is, and of course this ties in with what we were just saying. The thing is, this isn't going to go away. It's like John Houghton's misquote. It's like Murano and Solomon's claims. These things are going to keep coming up over and over again, and because once they're out in the public domain, the damage is done, and the correction. It's that selective thing of where people will remember the original article and they will never remember the correction.
Yeah, I mean, Tim Lambert, who blogs at the Deltoid blog, has a good list of kind of the more prominent members who now also need to issue a correction. And I'll just read them off quick. It's not terribly long because he's only looking at the more prominent ones. Margaret Wendt, Glenn Reynolds, Lorne Gunter, Michael Barone, The Daily Mail, Andrew Bolt, Miranda Devine, Christopher Booker, Terence Corcoran, Jonathan Adler, Dennis Bray, and Steve McIntyre. All those people now need to add corrections because they all base their stories on the false Jonathan Leak article. So I'm not going to hold my breath for those corrections, but if they were responsible journalists, they would issue a correction immediately.
Sure. I don't want to crack you up or anything, Dan, but another person who has also used this information, of course, is our good mate, Viscount Christopher Monckton. So what do you reckon? Do you think we'll be seeing a correction from him anytime soon?
No, which is why I'm not going to hold my breath. The last thing I do want to note is that Jonathan Leak, the reporter who wrote the original Amazon story that misrepresented the situation, is known for his bad science reporting. He has a whole list of bad articles written, and again, this has been chronicled by Tim Lambert, who blogged at the Deltoid blog. If you look, search, we'll have a link to it in the show notes, but he's got a whole tag called Leakgate, and there's a lot of stuff there that just makes me shake my head. I don't know how someone like that can be a reporter and keep his job.
So he's pretty consistent then?
Consistently bad, yes.
Okay, fair enough.
Up next, the Skeptic Debunk of the Week.
A 2009 survey found that over 97% of actively publishing climate scientists are convinced humans are changing global temperature. A study came out this week surveying a larger sample of climate scientists. They found almost identical results. Between 97 to 98% of climate scientists are convinced by the evidence that humans are causing climate change. So what about these petitions that list thousands of scientists who are skeptical of man-made global warming? The thing is, very few on these lists are actual climate scientists. There are medical scientists, zoologists, and engineers, but very few whose area of expertise is climate science. Why do such an overwhelming majority of climate scientists think humans are causing climate change? Because what they see is multiple independent lines of evidence converging on a single coherent answer. The reason there's a consensus of scientists is because there's a consensus of evidence.
And on a more humorous note, because we don't want to end on a downer, we have a story about sperm whale poop and CO2 sequestration.
Okay, sperm whale poop. Right. Okay, I'm not sure I signed up for this, Dan. What's happening?
Well, Australian researchers calculate that Southern Ocean sperm whales release about 50 tons of iron through their feces every single year. This promotes the growth of phytoplankton, which then absorbs CO2 during photosynthesis. At least they supposedly absorb CO2. The reason I say supposedly is because over the last decade or so, many groups of scientists have tried to experiment doing the same thing, to suck CO2 out of the atmosphere by putting iron in the ocean. And these experiments have not really been successful. The biggest one, a German experiment, put 6 tons of iron into the Southern Ocean in 2008, but saw no sustained increase in carbon uptake. So I'm not sure that what the whales are doing by pooping iron in the ocean is making a big difference. But it is an interesting story, and regardless of where the truth actually lies on the CO2 sequestration of sperm whales, it's worth noting that we are really talking about a very small quantity of CO2. So in the big picture, it's not going to make a big difference. But it does give us a new reason to save the whales. Yep, that's it for this week's show. The show notes will be posted at irregularclimate.com. Also at the website, we've got plenty of RSS feeds for subscribing to the podcast. We're also in the iTunes Music Store, and if you're there, why not write a review or give us a rating? We'd like 5 stars, please. And we're not yet in the Zune marketplace. Microsoft seems to take their time to add podcasts to their marketplace, but we do have a link on our website that if you click on, we'll subscribe you to the podcast if you own a Zune. We also have links to our Twitter and Facebook pages, so you can follow us, you can send us feedback, and if you feel so inclined, you can support the podcast by donating to Irregular Climate. We've got buttons on our website. It all goes through PayPal. But if you're unable or unwilling to donate, please continue to download and listen. That really helps. That really does. Just your download does support the show and helps it grow. I am Dan Mutal. You can follow me online at ofdan.ca, where you can see links to my blogs, my Twitter feed, my Flickr feed, and everything else I do online.
And I'm Graham Wayne, and you can find my writing at gpwayne.wordpress.com. There's also a downloadable track of the theme music to this show, if you'd like to listen to the whole thing. And an old essay or two about issues relating to consumption and climate change and where we might be going next.
Thanks for listening, and until next week, try and stay regular.